It's great to see you. It's nice to be back at Grace. I feel like I was just on a house party a week ago. It was probably more. Still got some scars from that hockey and things, but it's good to see you. And 2 Samuel 11, I hope you've got it open there in front of you. Let me ask you another question to get us thinking this morning. Lots of questions. This one. Have you got a moment in your family history, your family story, where everything kind of dramatically changes? You know, is there some event back there that, you know, generations on still carries echoes and, you know, resonances into the way people live today? Anything like that back there? I've got a few like that I can think of in my family. I think of my uncle, who was a hard-working tradie, sparky electrician in Wollongong, without a lot of money and working literally 3 8-hour shifts in the steelworks back-to-back. He'd sleep and wait for things to break down and go and fix them. And then trying to save and save and save enough money to visit friends in London. And anyway, he won lotto. He won first prize in the lotto. And suddenly his life changes. His family life changes. Everything kind of happens differently. I think of another member in the family, my great-grandfather, who 101 years ago, in a couple of weeks, steamed out of the Heads across to Albany, up to Cairo and off to war in Europe. And he survived years of combat in the Western Front, but came back a broken man in so many ways, shortened life, he'd never speak of it, but the impact of that war on him and that moment of deciding to sign up, get on that boat, head out, is something that still echoes down to me and I think to my kids as well. You know, we're shaped differently because of that. You know, there are moments in family histories that do that. Sadly, in one branch of my family, there was adultery that came in, a terrible betrayal of trust that saw a marriage and a family be shattered, all for a moment's kind of madness, and generations on now we're all impacted by that. So sometimes events that just happen so quickly get passed on and have a significance far beyond themselves. Well, the passage we just read is one of those moments for the family of God's people. Right? So if you belong to God's family, here is someone in your family history that did something that affected everything in a huge way. David, the great king, the one who had been promised by God to be his king, the one after his own heart, the one who was going to rule over the land, to expel the enemies, have all these victories, bring righteousness and justice and end the corruption that Saul had had, the one that God had made all these magnificent promises to. So many hopes are caught up in King David. And it looks like this glorious moment where David has kind of brought everything that God had started to promise seems to be coming true, and then we come to 2 Samuel 11. And this really is a turning point in the whole book and in the history of God's people, really. After this moment, everything is just downhill and fractured in ways that we will see. Have a look with me at chapter 11, because it starts rather innocuously. Chapter 11 there in verse 1 says, "In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war..." That sounds weird already, right? I remember reading this as a kid thinking, how come the kings go off to war at spring? Is that like the flowers coming out or, you know, animals being born or something? But spring, but still, apparently, in the Middle East, you have fighting season. You know, when it's safe to travel and when the snow isn't there and when you can pass without the ground being a swamp and so on. And so here it is. It's springtime. It's fighting season and it's the time when kings go off to war. David sent Joab, who's the commander of the army, Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army, and they destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. See, it was the time for the kings to go off to war, but this king stayed in Jerusalem. Rather than leading God's people in the battle to expel the enemies that he'd kind of said, instead, David's at home in the palace. Now that's weird because David is the one who we know as a warrior. What's the first story you know about David? David and Goliath. That's right. So right from the introduction of David, we see him come in as a fighter, as a warrior, you know? He would have killed the Nerf war last night, right? David would have had the measure of anyone that turned up. You know, all these wannabe heroes, David actually did the real thing. And battle after battle is recorded where he is the great hero that God's people had looked up to. You know, boys' own annual is kind of, the boys love reading these stories because there's so many exciting kind of adventures there. I'm going to wave to the camera. We're not going to notice it. Look at the camera now. You don't need to look at it again, okay? Everyone's like, have a good look. Have a good look. There it is. Okay. Everyone wave. Yay! There we go. All right. Back to me. Thanks, class. So here we are. He's in the palace, and it's worse than that because look at verse 2. One evening, David got up from his bed. Right now, anyone notice a problem there? It's evening time, and David is getting up from his bed. Right? If you have teenage boys, you can relate to this. You know, it's late in the afternoon, and they're ready to get up. Right? What is this king doing? He's not going out and fighting the wars. Instead, he's lazing around his palace. He's doing nothing. It's not complicated by the Hebrew or anything. This is what it actually means. And instead, what does he do? He gets up from his bed. He walks around on the roof of the palace. See that there in verse 2? And from the roof, he looks out and looks out across Jerusalem. Here he is. He's his city. It's his king. The domain is all his. And what does he see? He sees a woman bathing, right? She is very beautiful. She's also very married, as we'll find out. Now, don't picture this scene too closely if that's going to be a problem for you, but that's what David is doing. He's there and he looks out and there is this beautiful woman who is bathing and he's the king. It's good to be the king. And he has messages that he can send, and so he does. So he sends the messages out. He knows as he does this that it's Uriah's wife. Bring it to me. Bring it to me. And she comes. And notice how quickly it's kind of described there. She came to him and he slept with her. Doesn't dwell on the details. It just kind of gets straight to the point. Here he is, the king who's taking someone else's wife. David is no longer the great fighter and king. Instead, he's starting to look like a king who does things because he wants to and because he can. It's terribly recognizable, isn't it? This lazy, not going to war king, acting in this way, looking out away from the battle, spying her from on high. But there's a complication that as she then sends a messenger back to him after she goes home. Verse 5, the woman conceived sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. And David panics and he goes into cover-up mode. Bring in the spin doctors, figure out a strategy. What am I going to do in this situation? The law was very clear. Adultery was a crime that not even the king was exempt from. Crime punishable actually by death in the Old Testament law. And so he does go into this cover-up mode, and he does it so effortlessly that you can see how he came to power, kind of humanly speaking. David sends the word to Joab, his general, send me Uriah the Hittite. So he brings the husband there before him. Joab sent him to David, and when Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was and how the soldiers were and how the war was going. You know, it's just the kind of chat you have with the person whose wife you've just slept with. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet, right? You stinky soldier who hasn't seen your wife for a long time, why don't you go and wash your feet? You know, the plan here is pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, if he can get Uriah to sleep with his wife, then there'll be no discovery. A child will be born, but Uriah will assume it's his. No real harm will be done with it. And so Uriah is sent out of the palace, and a gift is kind of sent after him from the king. But look what Uriah does. He doesn't follow that plan. Verse 9, Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and didn't go down to his house. Doesn't go near Bathsheba. He's not aware of any of these things that have taken place, I don't think. He just doesn't do it. And when David was told this, Uriah didn't go home. Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home? Look at his answer, verse 11. The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? Surely as you live, I will do no such thing. See, there's Uriah, the noble warrior, who's dedicated to the kind of holy task of being in God's army, you know, out in the field. He's on campaign. He's got something which has given him this calling that he's supposed to be part of. That means that even the good thing of lying with his wife isn't a right thing at the moment, because he's supposed to be on kind of combat duty mission setting, you know. And contrast that with David, who not only isn't out there in the battle that he should be leading, but he's back home, not in a tent, but in a palace, not refraining from his sleeping with his own wife and concubines, but instead he's sleeping with his soldier's wife. You know, it's pretty easy to see how terrible this action of David's is. But David doesn't give up. He thinks, how am I going to get Uriah and Bathsheba together? What's the great way to bring together this reluctant man and his wife? And so he thinks, I know, I'll ply him with alcohol. The oldest aphrodisiac in the world, right? Give him a good bottle of red and see what happens next. Stay here, stay tomorrow, come and have a drink, have an eat. And so he does. And at David's invitations, he ate and drank with him. And David made him drunk, right? You can just picture David getting him drunk, pushing him out the window, out the door in the direction. Bathsheba's down that way. Why don't you take these flowers, you know? And surely that's going to work. But again, it fails. Uriah sleeps on the mat among his master's servants and he doesn't go home. And now David switches to a kind of mode of cover-up, which is just awful. Look at it there in verse 14. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, to the general, and sent it with Uriah. In it he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." See, he doesn't even stop for a moment with his plotting. He's so quick. He's so Machiavellian in this that he even gets Uriah to carry his own death warrant. You know, take this message. Be sure not to open it, you know. Give it to Joab personally. And as Joab reads it, imagine that, looking at Uriah and send him out to his death. Why does Uriah have to die? Why does this innocent, noble soldier have to die? Well, we can't have David's sin discovered. We've got to cover it up. So we're kind of adding to adultery and lying and deception and coveting, and now we've got murder as well. David's working his way through the Ten Commandments, right? And here is this moment where he does this thing. Now, let's just stop for a moment before we see what happens and think, does this just sound like fiction? Or does this sound very recognisable, this action of David's? See, for me, it's stories like this in the Bible that describe humanity as it really is. And you get great writers like, I don't know, Shakespeare or someone who will come and will describe the human condition. I'm sure looking at passages like this, which shows a king who is noble in so many ways but deeply flawed, which shows someone who plots in a way that lets just terrible things happen to innocent people, and you start just going down rabbit holes that you can't get out of, and it gets worse and worse and worse. It's like one of those Coen Brothers films, if you've watched those, you know, where you just see bad things turning into terrible things, and a moment's impulse turns into having to cover things up with murder, and there's chaos that's brought on everyone that comes out of this one little act. And this one act where David is there on the roof and looking down is so recognisably human. And let me be terribly sexist here for a moment and say, men in the room, do you recognise this kind of moment where you're kind of looking out and there's an opportunity and there's a temptation? See, I had a friend who preached on this very passage and talking about that moment on the rooftop. And he said, this minister in a Church of England church in England, right? So in Australia, you might get away with it. In England, this was shocking when he says, do you know, I don't think there's any woman that's here in the room that I wouldn't sleep with if I had the opportunity. Right? This is a vicar with a collar, right? He just said this. Everyone kind of gasped. There was this horror and shock and outrage. But then everyone's kind of thinking, what, any woman? Not. And then they're thinking, oh, hang on, am I thinking about the rest of the room? Like, all of a sudden, people were realizing that, in fact, this is a description of a very recognizable human heart, right? The vicar wasn't saying he had plans to sleep with everyone who was there, but he was just saying that he can recognize this situation, where you have this power and this ability and this desire and this temptation, and then it's a question of whether it's followed through with or not. And David, in that moment, he fails. Fails big time. But he doesn't fail in a way that doesn't make him seem human. He fails in a way that's very recognizable. And we still see kings and rulers and presidents and prime ministers who go this way, who will use their power for their own ends, for sexual gratification, because they can. That was Clinton's confession after the Lewinsky scandal. He said, why did I do it? I did it because I could. He said that makes it terribly indefensible morally, but he said that was the reason. I did it because I could. And here's David. He could and he did. And now it's going to take the death of Uriah to cover it up. In fact, more than that, as he's sort of sent out, there's probably other soldiers around him who'll die as well in that. You know? This awful king who's no longer acting for the good of the people at all. And the report comes back to David. Lots of reports and messengers going back and forward, aren't they? The report goes back to David that Uriah the Hittite is dead. You see that there in verse 24. And then verse 25, David tells the messenger, say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as the other. You know, press the attack. You know, let's move on. He doesn't even mention Uriah's name. No indication, of course, of his own complicity in this. No confession of guilt, no acknowledgement of sin, not a moment's thought even for Bathsheba here. Instead, he says something sickening, really. Comes out with this pious, twaddly, treacle stuff about the sword will devour one as well as the other. Really? Come on, David. Who's the sword going to devour? The one you've plotted to kill. You know? That's what's taken place here. Judgment has fallen on the innocent one because you've been guilty and you've tried to cover it up. Don't give us this saccharine stuff about the sword falling on one or the other. And yet he seems to get away with it, doesn't it? Bathsheba's a bit more honourable, as she's described there in verse 26, interestingly, as Uriah's wife, she mourns for him. She grieves him. There's sorrow in her soul there. And she goes and into his house and bears David a son, and that story goes on and has its own consequences. But notice the very last line in this chapter. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. See, God hasn't been mentioned in the chapter up to now. Did you notice that? There's lots of plotting and scheming and people doing one thing or another, but no fear of God and no thought that he would be watching over or an agent in history concerned with what's taken place when this is his king that's acted in this way. And God is not pleased. And as we go into chapter 12, we see that David's going to learn that you can't hide your sin from God. You know, he should have learned it from Adam and Eve. You know, those, you know, the old fig tree strategy. You know, we'll just cover this up. God won't notice, you know. This won't work. Even great ones like David forget that there is a greater one who sees all. And David might be able to fool the whole nation through his plotting and scheming, but he's not going to fool God. And David, who's been sending messages back and forward to accomplish his purposes, now has a messenger sent to him by God. And the messenger, Nathan, tells this prophetic little parable of a story which will trap David completely. With infinite cleverness, David is caught by this story. Listen to it, chapter 12. Nathan tells David, there were two men in a certain town, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he'd bought. He raised it, it grew up with him and his children, and it shared his food, drank from his cup, even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveller came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveller who came to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." And then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. You are the man." See, just as David judges the character in this story, he fails to recognize that it's telling the story of what he has done. And now he's been caught. He's been exposed. Nathan says to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despise me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret. I'll do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." So you remember where we started by talking about these terrible events that spill over into families for generations? Here is that moment for God's people. See, as he does this, a sword is going to fall. Remember David before saying, "Yeah, it's a sword, you know, it could go one way or the other." Here we have the prophetic word from God saying, the sword's going to rise from within your own household and it's going to be cutting it to pieces. It's going to be father against son. There's going to be brother against brother. It's going to be a civil war amongst David's, the generations following David. You know, no longer will God's people be united as they are under David. It's this awful moment where you see judgment taking place within the family, the household of God. And David admits at that point his guilt. He's been caught and he acknowledges his sin against the Lord. And perhaps the most shocking thing here is Nathan's reply to that. The Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because by doing this you've made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. See, God's grace will cover his failing king here. David clearly doesn't deserve it. He's unworthy to be spared. He should be judged straight away, but God's mercy will cover even that judgment. But judgment will fall, and this, you know, there'll be a son who dies, there'll be a nation that's torn apart. Things will not be as they should be because of the sin. Psalm 51 picks that up, where David spells out, you know, against you, you only have I sinned, O Lord. Strange, isn't it, that David can acknowledge that sin really is against the Lord in such a strong way. David recognizes that he's kind of coming under God's judgment like that. So where do we take a passage like this? What are we supposed to learn from this? Well, I think there is a warning here for us not to think that we're immune from falling in this very way, to realize the danger of sin and the futility of trying to cover things up and thinking that we can scheme our way out of it. Even if we're not caught by people, God sees and knows. And yet, this really is not here as a morality tale. It's not really here to say, don't be like David. In the household of David, the son who will rule over a kingdom that will never fail, that will never fall, that won't be divided by this kind of civil war, a better king, a king who will go into battle for his people, fighting the enemies that they could not fight alone, liberating them from the death that would otherwise face them, saving them. And we need to see the beauty of Christ as our glorious King, the one who is victorious when others would fail. How is he victorious? Well, he's victorious in part because when he's tempted, he is without sin. He's tempted as we were in every way, and yet is without sin. When you get to the gospel, you see a description of Jesus, which I think is remarkable. Just as you look back at David and you see David being described as a very real human because he's so flawed, you see in the Gospels a very real Jesus who is so righteous and without sin and yet is so recognisably human. This is not a creation of fiction. This is one living as we ought to live. This is one living the true life that we were kind of made to live, showing us what it means to really be human in a way that David even doesn't. See, he goes to the cross as the only one who is righteous in that way. And we're going to remember his broken body, his shed blood. See, his body broken for his people, his blood shed out for them. There's his victory moment. Here is what the king needed to be doing all along. The one who says, you know, come to me and bring your sin, and he will take it to the cross. This is the king that comes not using his power against his people, abusing them, seeing them killed and crushed under his rule, but instead the one who gives his life, whose coronation is a crown of thorns. Here is the king who does not stay in his royal palace, but instead gives up that power to serve others, to go into battle and to save his people. Amen.